now modern game theory, namely a combination of a strategy which both maximizes a gain and minimizes a loss, and does it simultaneously. Game theory is generally credited to von Neumann, but there are other predecessors. But it's not important. The thing is that von Neumann was very brilliant. My father had... we're very complex guys. Well, in any case, I was talking about von Neumann. My father had great problems at the University of Wisconsin when the department chairman, the very famous economist Richard T. Ely, the founder of the American Economic Association, had commissioned my father to revise Ely's famous book on the American labor movement. And my father had done the job, but had completely changed the interpretation from Ely's original Christian socialist interpretation to my father's own view that trade unions were in most countries where there had been an experience in self-government, were institutions committed to making the job right a collective property right for workers. That is, as John, King of England, in 1215 was forced in Magna Carta, MAGNACARTA, to grant the nobles of England clear title to their own lands, with the proviso that the lands could not be taken from them without conviction by the peers of England. The peers in this case were the House of Lords. Or on a formula developed by the House of Lords as a means for taxation. By the following century, the business people, the merchants of England, had had that same view applied to chattels, chattels, that is, movable property. And my father's view was what the American labor movement was largely about in the latter part of the 19th and the 20th centuries, was an effort to make labor unions the protector of the job property right. In any event, this led Ely to not renew my father, to refuse to renew my father's contract. My father tried to get a job at Cornell. The department at Cornell overwhelmingly recommended him, but the president refused to take it to the name to the trustees because of the anti-Semitic policy of the university at that point. Eventually, my father had no job, and Mrs. Commons, the wife of my father's major professor, decided to lead a palace revolution against Ely. The great sociologist Edward Ellsworth Ross, who was in the economics department, was given his own department. Commons was given a relief from teaching undergraduate courses. Commons, it turns out, was a horrendous lecturer. My father took over his undergraduate courses,
Cornell.
At Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
Incidentally, Sumner Sichter got the job at Cornell. Hmm. However, the fact is that my father went through a bitter, bitter time. Now, Ely's daughter, Anna Ely, had married a public utility economist by the name of Edward Morehouse, M-O-R-E-H-O-U-S-E. And the Morehouses, that is Anna and Ed, remained very friendly with my father throughout this period. One wonders why, but the answer is simply that there was division within the Ely household, and they asserted their independence from this rather domineering busybody, the father, by supporting my father. Well, the Morehouses were living in Princeton. And when Einstein said to me, "You ought to meet von Neumann," I called up Anna Morehouse and said, "I'd like to meet von Neumann. Can you arrange to have me invited to a dinner where he is going to be present?" Earlier, I mentioned that Princeton tended to be quite formal or stuffy, and there was always a problem at tables, at dinner tables, of matching the table. If you wanted to invite a widow, you certainly had to invite a male. Well, as men died for the most part before their wives, there was always a need for young men to, quote, balance the table. And so, without any trouble, Anna Morehouse arranged to have me invited. In fact, so good a job did she do that I was invited to two different parties. The first one was on something like a Friday night, and von Neumann was holding forth on the necessity of giving Stalin an ultimatum: abdicate within 3 days or we will atom bomb Moscow. Since von Neumann had family had suffered very much during the communist regime under Bela Kun, B-E-L-A. Kun, I think, is K-U-N, but it may be K-U-H-N, I don't remember. After World War I in Budapest, he was quite prepared to atom bomb any communist society. All of us who were clustering around the great man said nothing. Since he got no response, von Neumann concluded the topic by saying simply, I will tell you that this option of this kind of an ultimatum won't last very long. Mm-hmm. The Russians will get the bomb. Mm-hmm. Well, by that time, it turns out the Russians had the bomb, so much for that. The following week, early in the week, I was invited to the other party. Von Neumann recognized me. There's no reason why he shouldn't have. I had seen me 3 or 4 nights before, 5 minutes before. And he said, we've met before. I admitted it. He said, what do you do? I said, I'm in economics. And he said, oh, he said, it's a very advanced subject, much more advanced than physics. I said, that's counter to the popular view. And he said, I know, he said, but the economists know what they're up against. Whereas the physicists are living in their own kind of fixed dream world. When they come to grips with the question of an expanding universe, they'll discover that all of their physics doesn't mean very much, or something to that effect. In any case, it was an interesting experience. Well, so much for that period. The following spring, I told my father that I had thought that I would go off to Europe to one of the DP camps, find a girl, marry her, bring her into the United States. The law at that time permitted a woman to assume the citizenship of her husband, and then divorce her.
Or lose it.
I'm sorry?
Or lose her citizenship.
Yes, yes. And I don't know about losing it.
What year was this?
This was spring of 1948. Mm-hmm. My father was extraordinarily alarmed. And I remember he even went so far as to call me on the telephone, which almost never happened around our house. Long-distance calls were difficult in those days and prohibitively expensive. But he said he wanted to talk to me before I did any such thing. And later on, there was some correspondence, and he said to me, you're a fool if you think that you have the capacity to wash your hands of an injured pigeon simply by bringing her into the United States. You think you can never do it. Do you really know what you're getting into? Now, here I should digress. My father's education in Bialystok, B-I-A-L-Y-S-T-O-C-K, at the Russian Real Gymnasium, capital R-E-A-L-G-Y-M-N-A-S-I-U-M, had been the result of two very wealthy Jewish families marrying their children, the result of a marriage between two very wealthy Jewish families.
You told us that.
And his education... Mm-hmm. Was the result of this tie. Mm-hmm. During World War II, I think in the summer, probably, of 1942, Oswald Trilling came to Madison. His wife, that was the marriage. And my father and Trilling became very friendly. Trilling was a remarkable man. He had owned the mills in Bialystok. After the Russian Revolution, during the period of the new economic plan, he had gone to Russia and set up factories. I remember his telling me that he had a conference with Lenin when the two men were arguing. And Lenin said, well, in the end, we will kill you, capitalists. And Trilling, quite along the lines as I remembered him, a very mild-spoken person, but with tremendous force, said, but in the meantime, you will need us, and you will have to tolerate us. Well, Trilling, an eminently practical man, had managed to get French citizenship during the 1920s, and although he lived in Poland, he didn't have to depend on the good-heartedness of the Poles to get along. And as Polish good-heartedness towards Jews was pretty minimal, he did very well. The Trilling family had, she had a child from the first marriage, whose child, let's say her grandchild from the first marriage, was the same age as the child that she had with Trilling. The younger child, that is to say, her child of the second marriage, his name was Leon Trilling, and he became a very well-known professor of rocketry at MIT. Well, in any case, I don't want to get ahead of my story. Trilling found himself in Paris at the time of the fall of France, took a suitcase full of money, and went to Portugal. In Portugal, he went to the Consul General of Cuba, as he told me the story, and said to the Consul General, I have always been interested in Cuban charities. Here is $100,000 cash, which I would like to give to Cuban charities, and gave him the money. The Cuban Consul General understood which was his favorite Cuban charity, and the family got visas the next day. What is even more remarkable to me was that he ran into a relative of ours, Simon Shabrinsky, S-H-A-B-R-I-N-S-K-I, whom he, of course, did not know. Shabrinsky was a good business operator and entrepreneur, but on a relatively small scale, nothing like the Trillings. But times make strange bedfellows. And when Shabrinsky mentioned to Trilling that he didn't know what to do, Trilling said, how much money have you got? And Shabrinsky, who had money, said, why? He said, I think we should buy a silver service. That is to say, a solid silver tray, an English silver service, a teapot, a coffee pot, a creamer, a sugar, I think what the British call a slop basin. And he said, I will take you to my friend, the Cuban consul. He said, they went to the Cuban consul, as Shabrinsky told me the story. And Trilling said, I forgot when I spoke to you yesterday to include my secretary. Here is a gift for you. There was no nonsense this time about what was the consul general's favorite Cuban charity. And that's how Shabrinsky came to America. In any case, when the Trillings and my father became very friendly during the summer of 1942. Trilling had come to the United States from Cuba, and when he tried to get an apartment in one of the better apartment houses on the overlooking the Lake Michigan in Chicago, and they refused to have him because he was Jewish, he bought the apartment house. According to Trilling, as he told me the story, he came to America with $3 million in his suitcase. That's how you handle money. I might add, for those who don't know it, that in those days there were $1,000 bills. The sheer bulk was somewhat reduced. In any case, the Trillings and my father remained very, very close friends. After the war, Trilling, when I was at period, I was at home. I was studying at the university.
Wait a minute, why did you tell us the Trilling story?
I'm going to come to that in just a minute, because it's a very interesting story about American Jewish history. After the war, when I was living at home, Trilling explained to my parents that they had discovered one of his grandchildren, or actually two of his grandchildren, two girls, who had been protected during the war. Money had been given to their Polish nursemaid, and the Polish nursemaid had taken care of the girls. As the order of the girls matured, she began to look too Jewish, too non-Slavic. And the nursemaid had said to her, "I have bought you papers, but I cannot protect you any longer." And this daughter, whose name was Lillian, had been picked up by the Gestapo with Polish papers and went to work as a field hand in a German estate in the Rhineland. In the summer of 1946, Trilling said to my father, "We have found these girls, and Lillian we are bringing into America," and I will come to Lillian's story shortly. "But the baby is still in Poland, and there is a problem. The problem is that she has grown up, she has become a schizophrenic, and getting her out of Poland will be very difficult, and getting her into America will require a special act of Congress. But that's what my money is for. Can you do anything to help me?" Now, the Polish ambassador to the United Nations and to the United States, and later the Polish foreign minister, was a very eminent economist by the name of Oskar Lange, O-S-K-E-R-L-A-N-G-E, whose wife was Jewish, but he was not. Lange had taught at the University of Chicago, and Naomi, my wife, always, who was a student, always said that he was by far the best teacher she ever had. Lange was a great admirer of my father, and my father was a great admirer of Lange. Lange was not happy at the University of Chicago, and my father had started the wheels rolling to bring Lange to Wisconsin. In 1944, Franklin Roosevelt asked Lange to go back to Poland after the war and to be the pro-Western influence, the socialist, anti-communist, pro-Western influence. Mrs. Lange, who was Jewish, refused to go along, and they were divorced. Lange went back to Poland. And my father, when he heard, and by this time he was Polish foreign minister, I believe, when my father heard Trilling's request, he wrote a rather impassioned letter to Lange, saying that he owed everything he had to the Trilling family. This was an emotional debt that he could never fully repay, but this was the one, he had never asked anybody for this kind of intervention before, but this was the time that you asked people for such intervention. I remember the letter went off, and we heard no more. One day in July of 1947, the telephone rang in the evening. It was from Western Union saying that that my father had received a cablegram from Poland. The cablegram read, "Your obligation is fulfilled." I heard it over the telephone, signed Lange. Now, what happened was, as we later learned, that the nurse was reached at 7 o'clock one evening. They were living in Warsaw. And she was told, "Here are two passports with two visas that expire at midnight. There are reservations on an airplane to take you to Stockholm. Be there." Mm-hmm. And that's how they got out of the country. Well, I was getting out. I went in the course of the year at Princeton. My father suggested that I take out Lillian. She was the one who had been a German slave laborer, and her story I found rather important. And I mention this not because it's essential to my life, but it explains the way we viewed things in this period. Well, I took Lillian out several times. I must say that I did not find her an easy person to deal with. I remember taking her to the opera and having her fall asleep. Every time I nudged her to wake up, she would fall asleep again. But she was an interesting and wonderful person. But she told me the story of how she had been a slave laborer and how she had decided that the thing to do was to cross the lines. And during January of 1945, she managed, with a few others, to get through the German lines and get to the Allied lines on the other side. And she was picked up by the British. And the British put her to work in an officer's cafeteria. And when she was serving food one day, she served pork to an army chaplain. Happened to be a Jewish chaplain. He remonstrated with her that she didn't know that he didn't eat pork. He was Jewish. And she said this was the first time since she was, since 1940, when she had ever heard the term Jewish except in opprobrium. And she became quite hysterical. The chaplain wondered why, discovered who she was, what her family connections were. And from that time on, things began to move rather rapidly, and she was admitted to this country. But I was very much interested in my relationship with Lillian. I think the Trillings were interested in promoting a long-term relationship, but I was much too frightened of her. She had had too many traumatic experiences, and I felt far too weak. Well, I suppose the word isn't really weak, but I had my own agenda, and my own agenda, which involved a professional career, was not compatible with a person who had as many problems as I thought she did. I might add, to end the story, that the little girl who went to Sweden, eventually a special act was put through the Congress and she was brought to the United States. And that's except for the fact that I remember meeting Leon and becoming quite friendly with him again. I had met him during the war, becoming quite friendly with him again the year that I was teaching at Harvard. Well, that's the end of the story.
Excuse me, I don't want to interrupt, but you brought up some incidences of bribery, is what they were.
Yes.
Was this something that was prevalent throughout Europe, not just for that purpose, but in many instances? I'm not aware of it being so popular here in the United States.
Well, remember, this was the spring of 1940. The world was falling apart. The Germans had walked through Europe pretty much the way a warm knife cuts through butter. Everybody was desperate. People were known to give the keys of an automobile to someone else for a sack of oranges. Property didn't mean anything. Lives were what meant things. And what was remarkable about Trilling's gift to Cuban charities was probably that he sized up the fact that the going price for a visa probably was $20,000. And by giving $100,000, he wowed the guy. Mm-hmm. I'm quite prepared to argue that the difference between talent and genius is knowing when $100,000 will get you everything, whereas $10,000 or $20,000 won't. I am one of the principles of my life as an administrator has always been that if you will do voluntarily on Monday what you're going to have to do anyway on Thursday, you'll get credit for being a good fellow. And I think this is the bribery story. Now, I'm relatively aware that there is a great deal more bribery in life than most of us are willing to admit. But the bribery often takes the form of flattery or being a good fellow rather than money. Being a good fellow meaning I'll introduce you to the right people. Being a good fellow meaning I will. You can depend on me to help you out. You do me a favor, I'll do you a favor. The Italian phrase, which I love and translated, is one hand washes the other and together they wash the face. The story of the bribery didn't surprise me. What did surprise me at that time was, this is how a clever person does it. I would not have had the option of giving $100,000, but if that's what it took, that's what you give. I think that answers the question as best I can. Well, anyhow, shall I go on? When I told my father that I planned to go off to Europe and marry a girl, he said to me, look, Lillian Trilling has millions of dollars behind her, and yet you're frightened by her. What are you doing with somebody who has even worse experiences, because Lillian was never in a concentration camp? What kind of judgment is that? And it had a great deal, his words had a great deal of impact on me. It was part of a general emotional education, where I began very slowly to learn that doing the right thing might have a price which I would be unable to pay. And I would have to live with myself, having realized that I had chosen not to do the right thing. But it was my own failing that I had to grasp. This was one of many experiences that I've had in my life where this truth emerges. One topic which emerges here is, what was the nature of my sympathies? In the army,
sympathies to what?
My sympathies, generally. In the army, I had been very much opposed to the integration of the black and white soldiers. I remember telling General Abbott, the Brigadier General, that white soldiers would never obey a black non-coms, and that if they integrated the service, they would lose the wonderful black non-coms. Of course, I was totally wrong. I was extraordinarily concerned about equal treatment for blacks, but it never occurred to me that something like affirmative action would be the law. Equal treatment to me meant equal treatment. My perception of prejudice was that a person who was qualified, clearly qualified for the job, in fact, head and shoulders better than anyone else, would be denied the job simply because he was Jewish, or he was a black, or he was a Catholic, or God knows what. While I was at Princeton, I recall having long discussions about these views, and my opinions were very much tied up with what was called consequentialism. If you gave blacks certain equal rights, what price would they have to pay if these rights were enforced? And for the most part, my conclusion was that unless they were very able, they would have a hell of a time. My father, in the year I was at home, was the first professor at Wisconsin to hire a black graduate student. His name was Thomas Posey, P-O-S-E-Y, professor at some black college in West Virginia. I remember that the University of Wisconsin that year appointed as a visiting professor Alan Locke. I think Alan in this case is A-L-A-I-N, L-O-C-K-E, a very eminent Harvard philosopher who had been a Rhodes Scholar, and who had been recognized early on as brilliant. I recall that at a dinner party, Locke remarked that he was the first black professor at the University of Wisconsin, albeit on a visiting basis. And I recall my father saying, well, he wasn't as impressed with that as he was impressed with the fact that he had hired a black graduate student who was not significantly better than all the other graduate students. Not that he was worse, but that he was just a run-of-the-mill graduate student, and saying that the university should get no credit for having somebody like Locke on its visiting faculty, whereas the university should be given credit for having Tom Posen. I was never much tied up with the black civil rights movement. And the reasons for that I will come to later on when I talk about Jacob Agus, the rabbi in Baltimore. But the reasons for that were much associated with my sense of consequentialism. What happens if you allow blacks to register in the medical school because they're black? What kind of doctors will they become? What happens when if you allow women to have equal opportunity to men? What will happen to the family? Now, this is I'm not sure that I know the answers, but the important point is that I didn't know the answers. I remember arguing with one girlfriend I had, Susanna Eby, that I really thought that there were sex roles, and life might be